Welcome to the Queer Arabs podcast. This is Alia, and usually I'm here with co-host Ellie, but it's just me this time. I'm Saudi American and a lesbian, and then Ellie is bi, trans, Lebanese. She's usually with me, and just check out the rest of our episodes and get to know her if you haven't. Today I have a really amazing guest on, and I'm super excited. Amina, can you introduce yourself and describe to the listeners what you do?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me, Alia.
Thank you.
My name is Amina May Safi. I am an author based in Los Angeles. I write young adult fiction. My first book is called Not the Girls You're Looking For, and I say it's my ode to mean girls, messy friendships, and bad decisions, and it follows Lulu Saad in her junior year as she makes a mess of her family and her friendships during the holy month of Ramadan. And my second book is Tell Me How You Really Feel, and it is an enemies to lovers rom-com featuring two girls on opposite sides of the social scale as they work to make a movie and try very hard not to fall in love. It's a rom-com, so spoiler, they fall in love. I feel like that's kind of par for the course.
And they're like, I just want to embrace my enemy ship. Let me embrace it. But they can't.
Yeah. I love enemies to lovers. Like, I will read the worst written stuff if it's enemies to lovers, because it's my favorite thing on planet Earth.
I love enemy vibes, because I feel like if you have that strong of feelings for an enemy, like, who knows what that'll turn into.
It's like the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference, right? Like,
totally.
Like, you care deeply. I actually had this conversation with my agent about how also enemies to lovers, when you're talking about any kind of classic rom-com, is like the one space where, like, kind of mouthy, brassy, ambitious women get to be the lead.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a good girl who's angelic. It's like this girl, it's usually a woman with a career. It's a woman who's witty, who's funny, who talks back, like, that's where she kind of got to live when we were talking about, like, the classical idea. Like, I'm going all the way back to, like, Shakespeare, right? Like, that was where that character got to actually have her leading lady moment. And I think that's why I was always drawn to it. And I think that's why I put two ambitious girls who just go toe-to-toe. It's also my Paris Rory ship, too, because I just feel like
Gilmore Girls. Yes, yeah. I love it. Since we're on the topic, can you talk about, like, what the connection between Gilmore Girls and your first book? Or no, the second book, sorry.
The second book. Yeah. Tell Me How You Really Feel.
Yeah.
I was actually writing this enemies to lovers rom-com, and I was rewatching all of Gilmore Girls to rewatch it for the revival that came on. And I just started to think about how much I loved the Paris and Rory ship and how great it was and how it lasts through seven seasons and a revival. And that's really the great ship of that show. They start out as two young women who, like, push each other's buttons and push each other to be better. And they become, like, each other's greatest, like, confidants and allies and support system. And I just love that transition so much, and I love that they compete with each other and they find a way to compete in a healthy way rather than a destructive way. Like, I love everything about that.
They end up pushing each other to succeed and, like,
exactly
get better.
Because even when Paris is competing with Rory, she's like, well, don't you know you need to, like, also do other stuff to compete for college applications? It's like, Paris wants to beat Rory fair and square. She doesn't want to She doesn't want to, like, beat her because Rory doesn't have the information. She wants to, like, best her in that worthy competitor way, which I love. And I love that in a romance.
I love that. And, like, both of them, even though they start out as rivals, they both respect each other.
There's so much respect for each other and what each other is capable of. And that's, I mean, that's what's so fun about enemies to lovers is you take two people who hate each other, and the first thing you do is, like, you build their respect, and then you build their trust, and then you build their friendship. And it's, like, it's very cool to watch them begrudgingly, like, give each other these things on an emotional level, because it's very, very hard one and fun.
I like that dynamic so much too. Turning to you personally, what's your background like Swana wise, where you grew up, etc.? Anything you want to share?
So I grew up in Houston, Texas. I was born in Houston. Mm-hmm. My dad is from Iraq, so he migrated here for work in the 70s. He went through London in the UK first, and then he came here. He met and fell in love with my mom, who she grew up in Dallas, and she was in Houston. And her family is, it's funny, her family is, her father's from Mexico, so she's half Mexican, and then the other half is German-Texan, like German-Texan farming community.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I always think it's funny because when you say that, people always assume like she had one ESL parent, but she actually had two, because my grandmother's first language in those like small farming communities was German. So it is, I think I have this like very strong appreciation of a lot of languages and the way that cultures kind of come together in people. So my mom is mixed and I'm mixed. I am Muslim. I feel like that gets you. And I live in Los Angeles now.
It's so nice seeing a mixed character that will appeal to teenage girls. You and I are very similar in that, like, my mom is originally from the southern region of the U.S. as well, and my father is from Saudi Arabia. And so, like, I definitely relate to that dynamic of the cultures coming together, but also having that separation and having to figure out when you can bridge them and when you have to keep them separate and like navigating life. And it's definitely tricky.
I think you develop an appreciation for the ways in which things that are really, really different are actually very similar. And the ways in which like your parents who, like my parents, obviously, like my mom grew up in Dallas in the 60s and 70s, and my dad grew up in Baghdad in the 50s and 60s. Like there are ways in which they could not be more different. And then there's these other ways where they have these like deep, like common bonds that are so amazing to like see. And like watching that push pull was, to me, it could be really frustrating as a teenager, but the older I get, the more I just think it was really beautiful to be able to see that there is more than one way to live in this world, and there's more than one way to like live well and be happy, and that those differences can like get in an argument or butt heads a little bit, but they don't have to live separately from one another, right? Like they can coexist and they can fight, and then they can come to something better on the other side, or at least different, and they can come to an understanding that I think is really cool to watch, and that was really cool to watch as a kid.
And it's so cool to like, right, for us in our positions, like how we are able to foster those connections in certain ways that like maybe our family, like our grandparents might have, at least for me, kind of resisted my parents' marriage. But
on both sides or one side more than the other?
My mom's side more than the other, as far as I know.
Yeah, my mom's side too. It was
same. It was like what? A Muslim? Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A Muslim and an immigrant. What are you doing?
Right. What will the church say?
Well, and mine was funny in that it was my mom's extended family and like what I consider non-nuclear. So it was like my grandparents were all great on all sides. And obviously it's because like my grandmother on my mom's side also married like a Mexican man and an immigrant, right? Like she also did that.
Okay.
Yeah. So my grandfather immigrated and he met my grandmother.
Oh.
So I think like, yeah. So like my mom grew up, I think like that helped a little bit, but like it was still, I think, really hard for people to wrap their brains around. And I think people were always trying to like, I think what's difficult about being mixed race growing up or even growing up in a like multiple religious household is this idea that you have to be one thing. And I think when you grow up with all of these multitudes, you get really comfortable not just code switching, but understanding that like there's an ebb and flow of like who's in charge where, kind of. I put this in actually in Tell Me How You Really Feel, where Sana's grandmother is Iranian, she's Persian, and her grandfather is South Asian. And I wanted to like have that ebb and flow where it's like he's kind of in charge of all of the movies that she saw growing up, but like Mamani is in charge of like all of the food, right? Like there are these places where like somebody wins and somebody like where certain languages like take over and some places they recede into the background. And I think growing up like that, you become really comfortable with that. It's when you, I found that what was hard for me, I don't know if this is true for you, but like going out into other spaces and feeling like I didn't have control over what people saw and what people reacted to was that was what was hard for me. Yeah. It's like people felt very, and I think this is also growing up post 9/11 because I was 14 when that happened. It was very like, okay, pick a side, right? Like you're in one box or the other. And I didn't want to have to do that. And that's also why I wrote Not the Girls You're Looking For, because I wanted to really protect this in between space, because I think so much of the narrative is like, pick one and you'll be happy, versus you just have to be comfortable with the fact that like, you're never going to be 100% comfortable in any space. Like you're never going to fully fit in. And that's not a bad thing. I think we treat that as like, oh, that's so sad, versus like, it's actually really cool. Like you're going to be equally out of place in many places, but you'll also be equally in place in many places, that like many people only fit into one slot or a couple slots. And I think that that's more and more true, especially with the younger generation. Like they're more mixed, they're more aware of all of these multitude of identities that they carry with them, and they're learning to be more at peace with that, which I think is really cool.
Lately, I've been really happy to see celebrations of mixed identities versus like just the downsides of them and the struggles and stuff. So just like seeing the beauty being written about, or like art that represents that identity, and realizing like being mixed in a way is its own identity. It's you identify, you're connected with several identities, but then also, so at the same time, like being mixed is its own thing, and it's kind of cool.
Absolutely.
to acknowledge that and celebrate.
And even growing up, like I realized like I had so many friends who are also mixed, and I don't think it's because like, I mean, Houston is an incredibly diverse city, and that is something definitely worth celebrating. Which is also why I said the book there, because it's somewhere where someone like Lulu really does and can exist. But I think that I was always like really related to people, even if their mixed culture was different than mine. They understood what it was to have that push and pull, right? Like they got those areas where it was like they understood why I respected my parents being protective in some ways, and then they also understood why I wanted to push back in other ways, in a way that like friends that were just, say, like Anglo-American didn't quite get, or friends who were just Arab-American didn't get. Like it was they got that in between space of like trying to build something that was your own, because you have to in order to kind of both survive and thrive in that environment.
I relate to that so much. Just like feeling in many ways, like feeling more able to identify with other mixed folks, like regardless of like where their parents are from.
Because they know what it is to navigate that. A conversation is the wrong word, but it's like, it's a constant, you're never on steady ground, I think is the best way to describe it. And that doesn't mean it's a bad thing, but you're used to like navigating a ship through waters that are always changing. And that's how you live your life. And they get that, even if the specifics to them are totally different than the specifics to you. You get that under, it's like the specific is universal, right? Like theirs is specific to them and yours is specific to you, but they understand what you're doing and you get what they're doing too. And you get how they're moving through the world in a way that someone who's not multiracial might not always understand. And they might not intuitively get without, like I had plenty of friends who on either side were willing to listen and were open, and that was wonderful. But there is something about people who you can just use the shorthand and they get it.
It's refreshing sometimes to just like not have to articulate all of it. But at the same time, I agree. I appreciate people being willing to listen and learn about that experience. I totally get it. It's cool. You and I are very similar in age. I was actually, I was 16 when 9/11 happened. So you can probably relate to the fact that there just wasn't much literature growing up with characters.
It was Habibi. That was it. Like I love when I'm in a panel, because it's like I see everyone else who's either mixed or Arab in there, because I say, well, there, people are like, what did you have? And I'm like, well, I had Habibi by Naomi Shihab Nye. And there's just like this little bobbing of heads. I'm like, oh, I see.
Yeah,
we're the same age. This is what we had.
I remember that book. And then I remember like growing up on Sweet Valley books, and like, I mean, those books are fun. And to hear,
grew up on Babysitter's Club.
Similar literature,
which are actually a little bit better.
They're more diverse.
Yeah. Like there was at least enough diversity that you started to like kind of approximate yourself in places. You're like, that's not me, but like we have similar traits, and she's also not white, so I can get there.
At least there's that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Babysitter's Club was helpful in that aspect. I for some reason I was so stuck on Sweet Valley books, but in retrospect I'm like, no wonder I never felt really attractive, because like in those books, and I wonder if this is part of it, like in those books they're always saying like the twins had this beautiful blonde hair and these perfect ski jump noses, and like I just remember as a young kid reading that and feeling like, oh okay, so that's the ideal. My nose definitely doesn't fit that description.
I have to give my mom credit for this one. She always, and I think she knew because she grew up mixed race and she grew up with a slightly broader nose, and she grew up like in the 60s in Dallas, which is just its own
world,
you know. World. Let's go with world.
Totally.
And I think she was always pointing out people who had faces that were different from what you saw in the media, different from what is described in books, and like describing them as really, really beautiful. So if there was like a really beautiful Arab woman with like a more of a sloping like Arab nose, like she would be like, mm-hmm. isn't she stunning, doesn't she look regal, like she was really, really I good about that. Doing that at such a young age that like I never, and I feel really, really lucky because there's all of these other things that hit me later, but like those characteristics, like I grew up thinking that like those were the most beautiful women, right? Like the Arab women that I knew, just like, oh, their skin is so olive and their hair is so dark and like they have these features that to me are like the most beautiful thing. And I feel really lucky that I had that community and I had my mom like steering that, because you have to steer it, because the culture will tell you.
Yes, the culture will fight back against that.
But like I really want to like credit her for that, because that was amazing. And then I think
so glad
we were just starting to get, and I think this is because I am part Latina, like where you were getting some Latinx people coming in. And so I also had those women in media to at least like start to see myself in, right? Like J-Lo was just coming, Selena was mm-hmm. coming up when I was a kid, Jessica Alba. Like you had these like, you know, Selma Hayek, who's also, she's Middle Eastern Latinx. Like,
yeah, I think that's
that helped. Yeah, Shakira, same thing. Like, yeah, I think that I was constantly approximating myself and trying to find versions of myself that I could see, and I think that helped. But in books, yeah, it was really dim, to be honest.
I think I remember finding out about Salma Hayek and just being so excited.
Yeah.
It really does matter. It really makes it's life-changing to have that representation. It really does matter.
And it's not just like, that's a beautiful woman and I could be beautiful. I think that, right. You know, like, obviously, but it's also just like, my existence is not singular in a really good way. Like, I am not alone in this mixed identity, or I am not alone in being
like not an white Arab woman.
Yeah, like it's just feeling like you are not the first version of someone like you to exist that makes you feel like you're in a community, or you're not alone in that. Especially if you grow up in an area where maybe your community isn't around, or maybe like I went to school in a prep school that was very, very WASPy. So it was just like knowing that outside of that environment, there was more than what I was getting. Cause like whatever you see as a kid is what you think is normal. So I think that like giving those windows and mirrors and those opportunities, just, it's such a breath of fresh air. It's such a relief. Like I remember feeling relieved as a kid.
Yeah. It's when you find,
when I saw people like,
yeah, when you find people like that, people like you represent it. I know that feeling of relief is indescribable. Wait, I am valid.
I remember fifth grade was the first year I fasted for Ramadan, and there was another girl who was Muslim in my grade. And it was the first time I'd had another girl that was Muslim in my grade, like, ever.
Okay.
And, like, I think there was a couple of Muslim boys when I was growing up later, but like largely there weren't a lot. I wasn't in a grade with another Muslim girl. And
oh, wow.
It was just such a relief. Like, I just remember being like, my family, like, I'm Shia and she was Sunni, but it didn't matter because it was just like, we are doing this, and like, we can also both field questions from people. Like, I could sit by you, and like, you're gonna not eat, and I'm not gonna eat, and it's gonna be okay. Like, it was just, I still remember, like, it's still one of those things where like, it really felt like we were in it together in a way that was really beautiful at the time and still.
Right. In a context such as school, you are spending every day there, and like, if you're feeling isolated, I mean, that'll change the entire
experience. Isolated and hungry is really the worst.
Yeah, right. Are there any other issues you touch on? Well, I know there are, but can you talk about the other issues you touch on in your writing that Muslim girls can identify with?
I think in Not the Girls You're Looking For, I really tried to draw on the idea of like microaggression rather than like intense aggression. Like, I wanted to take the idea, and I think this is because I grew up after 9/11, is like, there were these moments, like after, say, a terror attack, where like the aggression kind of comes to the surface and it becomes really scary and really like physically dangerous for you in a lot of ways, be that bullying, like all across the spectrum.
Definitely.
And then I wanted to talk about those moments where that doesn't necessarily affect the story. Like, I don't want it to be a story about that issue, but I wanted to show the ways in which, like, even in a moment where other people might consider like the Islamophobia is at a low, like it's still coming through in all of these like other ways that not everyone else sees and not everyone else registers. And I really wanted Muslim girls reading that to see it, to feel seen in that way. Like, to, because so many people tell you it's not happening, or they tell you that that's not what that means. And I think just like acknowledging that those microaggressions happen, or that that's real, I think was really important for me. And for me to put on the page, like, there's a moment where Lulu goes, it's actually one of the few things that I've actually drawn on my real life, where she's taken on a date and a guy takes her to see a belly dancer. Like, he's there's going to be belly dancers at the coffee shop. Like, that really did happen. And I remember just being like, how do you not? I think I wanted to put things in there so that you can not feel insane when they happen.
Yes. Yeah. Even yeah,
like, I didn't even know that this was something someone could do.
And the person doesn't even get like why it's a problem or why it's weird.
Like, it impacts so much, and you're just like, I gotta go. Right
now.
Like, like, you're just want to hit the biggest eject button possible. Like, that's all you want to do. Like, danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Yeah. And even the small, like, I mean, it's not insignificant, but the small thing of like Layla, how she's like, oh, why does, well, Lulu, short for Layla. How she's like, why does everyone have to sing the song Layla when I just introduced myself? Why is it this big ordeal? Telling someone my name. And yeah. And,
when your name is often a minefield.
Yeah, just, you're like, do I have to go through this every time I say my first name? Like, people making it this big thing. Yeah, and it's not like it's done with bad intent, but it builds up over time and you just get tired of and over.
That's by a thousand paper cuts thing, and I wanted to do that. And then I also wanted to see more Muslim girls like me who identify as Muslim and practice, and also are like, I'm really, because I grew up with multiple religions and multiple cultures, I'm bad at the idea of strict rules.
Yeah,
and I always have. I think that I felt, especially growing up, like I felt like I was, bad Muslim is not even the right word, but like I was faking my faith at some level. And I just wanted girls to not feel that way. And I wanted them to know they're not alone in navigating the waters of their own faith and their own religion. Yeah. And I think we really isolate young women and we don't give them the tools to deal with that, because there's so much shame, like, kind of wrapped up in being American and Muslim, or potentially in having a sex life. And that's patriarchy, right? Like, that's not just being Muslim. Like, that's a lot of jinns and patriarchy. But I thought it was really important to just put it out there on the page and, you know, have a Muslim American girl going to the gynecologist.
Yeah.
Really nice to see when I was a teenager.
And being like, right, and being like, okay, this doesn't invalidate the fact that I'm Muslim just because I'm like going to an OBGYN, for example.
Yeah. Stuff, and I think like, that you're worried that if you start talking about that you will be less Muslim, or that you're And there's so much in that when you're mixed too, because like you're trying so hard to show the people you love and respect and care about who came to this country that you are not invalidating their experience and that you're not rejecting them. I think that's the really the hard thing to come to terms with is sometimes you will make different choices than the people who came before you, and they have given you this culture and this religion that you see as beautiful and that you feel as your own as well, and that you aren't rejecting them by making different choices. And I think that can be really difficult because I think sometimes older generations really think you are like saying no to who they are and how they lived their life. And finding a way to navigate that is something I think that it's a lifelong process. And I think it will always happen. And I think the more that you can verbalize and learn to communicate, which is always difficult with a different generation that grew up somewhere different, right, the better it gets.
Yeah. And I think people reading a book like books like this, it'll help like give young people tools, ways of bringing up conversations with older family members, hopefully knowing how to articulate certain issues that I know that I didn't know how to articulate growing up, or even knew there were a lot of things I didn't even know were issues.
You didn't even know the word for it, much less how to articulate the issue to someone else, right?
Right.
You didn't even tell yourself, much less someone else.
Yeah. And like, I didn't even know certain things were a problem until later in life. And in retrospect, I realized, wow, this really did impact my self-esteem or my body image or whatever it was. It's cool that people be able to access those feelings or those just those.
I think that fiction is, to me, fiction is still a space of play. So I think that's what's also important about fiction, is that it's not necessarily like me teaching you something, but you going into a space and envisioning yourself in a body that may or may not be like you, but that you are working through those problems with them and you are coming up with your own hypothetical solution. So even if you're not going to do what Lulu does or say what Lulu says, you're thinking about what those problems mean to you, and you're thinking about them on your own level. And that's, to me, the great gift of fiction, is like it teaches you to think, and it teaches you to think on your own terms. And you don't have to like a character or agree with her in order to come up with your own solution to similar problems you may or may not run into in life.
Yeah, or, definitely.
You know, like talking to your parents about something that's important to you. Like, we all have to do that at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, because like Lulu in the book does things that I'm like, oh, come on, Lulu, why? But it's also, but it's like, oh my God, she's a human. She's a teenager. Mm-hmm. Like, of course she's doing those things, you know? Like, and it makes me remember when I did some things that I wouldn't necessarily do now. Like, as a teenager, I'm just, thinking back to my teen years, being like, oh my God, I did think the way Lulu's thinking right now. And like, what is wrong with us? But it feels so affirming. It's affirming.
It is. It's affirming to know you could be your worst self and you can come out of it and you can
start
to become your best self, right? Like you don't live in that one space that you can grow and change. And I think that's why I love young adult, is you can start with characters in one place and they really, because they're in that age range, right? Like your brain is still forming. Like you're still developing who you are. Like you really are changing and you really are growing. And like, it's so fun to write on that level because you have characters that are changing and they get to do that in a way that I think in some adult fiction that people feel it's more serious to have them stagnate. And I find it's more interesting to watch people grow, especially when they don't have, I mean, young adults tend to have to, but the older you get, the more it's like you're choosing to grow and change. And that's also really rad.
Yeah, exactly. And as teenagers, it's like, okay, this development is so rapid. And I don't know, like reading about the way a teenager is thinking, you're like, oh my God, I totally did that at that age. What was wrong with me? But also it's okay.
Well, and I did that with Sana and Rachel, where like they have this misunderstanding where like you can see how Rachel thinks that Sana's asking her out as a joke because she's so pretty and popular and like so well established in this place. And you just think you're so in her perspective, and you also are so out of her perspective because you have the distance of the novel to be like, oh my gosh, no, she's not kidding.
Yeah, like, please listen to her.
I wrote it and I was like, she's not kidding. And she's like, she is messing with me. And you're like, oh,
you're like,
my
gosh. No, this is taking everything out of her to even bring this up.
Like, yeah, it's like you can, like, watching all of the clues in her that she's like, you can feel that Sana has, like, geared herself up to do this. right? Like, you can see that, but like Rachel can't see that at all. And I love that about teenagers, and because you're so self-conscious, but you're so unself-aware that it's this beautiful mix of like not always aware of what you're doing, but you are trying really hard, and you think you are sometimes more grown up than you realize, and sometimes you're way less than you're trying for. And it's a really fun mix, in my opinion.
Yeah, I feel like as teenagers, we're aware of things that no one else cares about. You're like, you zoom in on these minuscule things about yourself that literally no one thinks about. And you're like, your focus is on these things. Like, you're self-critical in a very specific way. And like,
so like, is everyone staring at me when I walk into lunch by myself in the cafeteria? It's like no one's paying attention to you at all. Like,
literally no one cares. Yeah. Yeah.
But you feel that sense of all eyes are on you.
Mm-hmm. As a teenager yourself, I know we kind of touched on this, but did you find any other characters you identified with besides like what we've already talked about?
Oh my gosh. I think I was always drawn to superheroes and fantasy. And I think because those are just largely allegories of things existing on this plane. So I love, as a kid, I loved Rogue. I think I loved the idea that if someone tried to harm you, you would touch them and it would like doubly bold kind of end up back on them. I think that was like, that really appealed to my sense of justice as a child. And then it had that like idea of forbidden romance with Gambit because she couldn't touch him, and that felt like I think that really appealed to like my love old Arab and Persian romance, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like the like kind of long-standing requited unconsummated love that I just filled with that I love. Yeah, I was really into Jane Austen, and I still am. And I think that those were those first books that made me feel and think at the same time. I love that they had big cast of characters. I love that there was a lot of family around. I loved that they were, again, romances based in banter and wordplay, and there was social commentary baked into something that you could also just enjoy for the plot. A lot of this is stuff I understood as I got older, but like I think that's what I was really drawn to. I talk about this on my Instagram, but I loved the Fast and the Furious movies because that was the first time I saw women that looked like me being really capable and making their own kind of romantic decisions and being in the driver's seat quite literally in a lot of the plot scenes. Yeah, and I was like 14 when those came out, and those were just I just remember thinking it was so wild, and it's so wild to this day to me too, because it's like you get characters like Mia and Letty who are these amazing female characters, and at the same time you still have to put up with like boobs as wallpaper and like just like the women in the background are such objects and the women in the foreground are subjects, and it's such a funny, it's not haha funny, but there's such a weird juxtaposition of like it always felt like this weird tax you had to pay to get this thing that you really love that comes with this other thing that is in a lot of movies that is just such
toxic.
It's so toxic. But I remember being 14 and just feeling like those were such a breath of fresh air, because
for sure
in myself she is like kicking some dude's ass on the car and like being in charge of herself and her own story and the affected plot and story in a way that most female characters didn't. I loved The Mummy for that reason too. It's deeply orientalizing, but it was also probably one of the last. It was so fun, and I realize now too, it was like, I think that Oded Fehr was also like one of the last, he played one of the last characters, like I know he's a noble savage character, but he's like kind of one of the last like positive Arab characters you got right out, like that came out like right before 9/11, and then it was just like a sea of terrorists. So I think that was also why my brain where I was like, he's a good guy, we're gonna be okay.
Interesting. I never thought about the timing of that.
Yeah, they came out like this summer right before, like one of them came out the summer right before, and I think it was kind of one of the last,
like
it was the second positive one, but it was like the last for a really long time in terms of like mainstream blockbuster films. Which is wild.
And there was probably
and
a
even
good...
Evie was like theoretically mixed based. I mean, it was Rachel Weisz who's very fair, but it was still like felt like there was something there.
There's something. I know, we took what we could get. Like
you were like, that's close, I'll take it.
I get. Yeah, because after 9/11, I want to say it was a solid decade or even more before we've started seeing like Arabs portrayed in a positive way. Maybe even longer than that. But
it was a while. I mean, like you got some Indian, you got some indie movies where like Alia Shawkat was in them, but she wasn't necessarily playing an Arab, like, and she's mixed race, and like, they were often like kind of downplaying that, but it was like, I knew, and I was like, well, that's okay,
That's
like,
something,
I can
yeah.
get that.
I know,
Again, I
I
can take that.
remember. I remember like seeing she like eventually finding out she was part Iraqi, and I was so excited. And then like the fact that she and I have the same first name, I was like, oh my God, she's like a
She's
famous
like
person
me.
with my name. But
But yeah, it was a while.
I know
It's
it
a
was
while.
a good chunk of time. I guess shifting to Sana, I want to mention like I'm so appreciate the queerness in the book, and just really exciting for me to find out about it, and see that in a book specifically for the demographic you write for. Anyway, so I was wondering, like, when we started this podcast, The Queer Arabs, we were like, oh my God, we're gonna get so much pushback. And we did get some, but it's mostly been positive. And I'm curious if that's been your experience too.
It's almost all been positive.
That's
And I
awesome.
think it's because I write for young people, and I have people, even like you, they're just like, thank, like most people just are like, thank you. I just
It's
wanted to see
awesome.
myself. And yeah. And so like, I get a lot of that, which is like the best, because that's why I wrote it, right? Like I try to write stories that are inclusive so people can feel seen, because I remember what it was like to just constantly try to feel seen or try to approximate myself. And I wanted to write a rom-com that was queer, that the tension point was that we get in the way of our own romance, not that the queerness gets in the way of the romance.
Oh,
And I felt like that was
awesome.
something I could write, because like I love a rom-com and I wanted to just kind of hit it beat for beat and just produce a standard rom-com. The characters just happen to be more diverse, and I wanted that inclusivity. So most of my response has just been people feeling seen and people feeling like they got the same thing that everyone else gets, and I think that that's really beautiful, and I feel really lucky that I write for young people, and that's what I get.
Yeah, and I love how you just portray the queerness, for example, as like just kind of a normal standard thing, like teenage thing, versus like, oh, I'm gonna focus on like how unusual this is, if you know what I mean. Like
Yeah,
I
I
appreciated that.
do. Oh, good. I think it's also, I know what it is to have that spotlight put on my Muslim identity, and I don't love it. And I think that there's this, I don't know if you've ever read Ship It by Britta Lundin, but she was talking about how so many queer stories, especially coming out stories, are centered on the straight people in the story. And I want to quote her on this because she said it so beautiful. I don't have the quote in my head, but it was basically like, so many of those stories are frustrating because they're centered on what will the straight person think of me, rather than telling them the way they should be, which is like a coming of age story, right? Like
I like
it's a
that.
coming of age, it's a sexual awakening. Like sexual awakening is a whole subgenre of coming of age, but like it needs to be centered on that person and not on the other people watching them or experiencing them. And I always felt that way too about stories about Muslim girls, because it always felt like there was an aside of like explaining the religion or defending a belief in the religion to like the inevitable white person reading that. And I really never want to do that. Like, I really want you to just be immersed in the perspective of the characters that I've written, so that you just feel as they feel, and you learn by living in it, in those moments where you open the book. And I feel like that's really important. And I feel like that's the important thing that fiction does, is it makes you feel and it makes you see without having to constantly explain yourself.
Yeah, it's
And
a
I think
very specific. Yeah, it's a very specific way to learn rather than like have it spelled out for you. Like everything spelled out for you. And
if you want it spelled out for you, like please get on a
like
Wikipedia. That's
maybe
totally
Google.
fine.
Yeah, learn about
I've done
learn.
like, fiction teaches you something beyond that, I think, or fiction can give you something beyond that. I think it was also like, I think younger generations are better about this because they have the internet and they have more access to all sorts of information. And then I think that I really thought about Sana's mom, Farah, and like she's my age, or like in my age range. And like, I think that that also shifts in terms of like, what would I do as a mom, or what would I do if my, like, I would hope that I would be a much better parent and a much more open parent about my child being queer than like whatever the stereotype is. And I feel like culture is so beautiful. And to me, I understand that there are people who still have to struggle with coming out within their culture. I don't think I can tell that story, first of all. I don't think that that's my story to dive into. And I also feel like there are plenty of people people who experience their culture and it's not always a tension point with who they are and their identities. And it doesn't have to be. And I wanted a story where it didn't have to be the stress point of the story.
The main, it was just like...
Well, they're true. Like, there's still struggles and people are still struggling and those are real and we need those stories. And then on the other side, I think we just need to normalize that people get to exist with all of these identities and have a love story and that's it.
And have, yeah, exactly. And like go through just typical teenage stuff, just like everyone else.
We're all teenagers.
Yeah, like we've all... We all deal with the mean girls and we all deal with struggling with self-esteem and all the same things as each other. And it's not like it's specific to one culture necessarily at all times. Even like another thing, like this is so this is such a minor thing, but it stuck out to me, like how you mentioned with Lulu, how you brought up the humidity and her hair. I was like, oh my God, someone with hair that's unruly like mine is. So that was really cool.
I actually remember that because I've read enough like vintage fiction, and I think this is because I was like an old mystery. I loved like golden age mysteries, and a lot of those, especially like the second tier ones, you often end up these characters that are like, my hair couldn't hold a curl or my hair fell flat, and it was such a foreign experience to me that like I was like, what are you talking about? And then I realized it was just like it was about a very specific kind of hair, and I just want to like also put my kind of hair or like a range of hair in my books. It's such a weird thing to like really care about, but I was like, hair that like frizzes and gets curly, or hair that someone like, and Senna's hair is also really important because she's like controlling it, so hers is always straightened, but I always imagine like there's a, she's always straightening it and then pulling it back, and like kind of there's a control element to like that tells you something about her, that her hair is in this straight sleek ponytail at all times. Like I feel like that's also indicative of who she is. And like Rachel tries to cut her hair earlier, like there's a flashback and she's like, oh my gosh, this does not look like it does on the gram.
Yeah
Like, does not use in the cool way that I have seen to find other cool ways that look like my hair.
Appreciate that so much. Like it actually, it does, like you said, it seems like it's insignificant, but it's really not. And I used a straightener for about 15 years, and just recently I've been like, why am I damaging my hair voluntarily every few days? And like
why am I fighting my hair? Right? Yeah, it's not that you can't straighten it, that you can't wear it that way, but like, why do I see, it's like me versus my hair. It doesn't have to be me versus my hair.
Yeah, it's okay to have waves. It's actually cool. Mm-hmm. I want to say it was a year ago, like as recent as a year ago, when I was like, wait, it's kind of cool wavy. I'll just let it be that way. And it feels it feels healthy, and it feels, it
was I did that a few years
ago. Did you do the same?
I was like, I think what was, the moment I realized it is that I was, this is going to sound so bananas, but I was blow drying it with a little bit of a curl into it and then curling it so it had sleek wave. Like it was like, I wanted waves, but I wanted them to be especially like kind of sleeker at the root. And I looked up and I was like, I just spent like all of this time and energy to make my hair look like an approximation of what it already does, but like what I think of as an acceptable version of that. Right. Like with product and shine and like there's no frizz, and I was just like, I have got to stop fighting it. Like I will occasionally straighten my hair because that's a look I want, but I think learning to like just accept that it is what it is, and I don't have to control it, and I don't have to tame it to make it acceptable for someone else, was like really freeing. And just letting it,
exactly,
like getting a haircut, like I get a cut now so that I'm like, it needs to look good with this texture, and it can look good with other textures, but like it needs to predominantly look good with the texture I have, which is wavy. I'm not super curly. I'm not as actually curly as Lulu is, or as that I envisioned Lulu is, but like it's still like just learning to accept it's not a battle I have to fight. It's just an aesthetic choice that I can make when I want to.
Exactly. And it's not like it's so nice. It's like, oh my god, the straightener is not the default. It doesn't have to be. It can just be like whenever I feel like it, but not the default.
Exactly. Yeah. It doesn't have to be the default. And I actually almost, it's like once I did that, I almost never straighten it. I think I've straightened it like twice in 6 or 7 years. Like it gets straightened when I go to the hairdresser.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, it's wild. It's wild how much you
it
think
is.
It's you fight yourself on things that are just the way you were made, and it's a funny realization to make as you get older and
for
realize
sure.
you don't have to fight the fight.
Yeah, and it's very symbolic. It's symbolic of other things. It's like the hair, it ties into so many other things, like embracing other parts of yourself. And
absolutely. Yeah. Well, and like many women are taught that their hair is not professional. I mean, like I can't imagine what Black women have to go through
know,
every day.
Yeah.
Like there's the culture element that you feel like you're denying or accepting your culture, and then people will tell you what that means. And then there's people at work telling your hair is or isn't professional, and they're like, mm-hmm. you're getting so much messaging and so much signaling, and it's a lot to navigate, and it's a lot of other people's bullshit that they're putting on you. And I think the more you can release other people's bullshit, the better. But it's really hard. It's really
yeah.
not an easy thing. It sounds really simple, but it's a difficult thing to do on your day-to-day life and to potentially face real-world repercussions for, depending
exactly.
on your hair.
Yeah, like actually yesterday I live in DC now. I went to the National Museum of African American History, and there's a whole section about hair, about what we're talking about, like little guides that were put out saying, you know, if you want to be part of our organization, these are the acceptable hairstyles. And it just like,
I mean, that's still happening.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
There are still schools that tell kids they can't wear dreads or tell kids they can't wear braids as part of the, like, and they're public school. I mean, it's not even in any school. It's tragic. And in a public school, it's just like, what? You can't.
I know.
So yeah, I do. I try to put as much different hair and wavy hair or curly hair or into, just so it feels normal, like those girls with the hair that wouldn't hold a curl in so much fiction that I read, because I just feel like, I think the danger is always, and this is again going back to being mixed race and the thing that I think I was given and mixed religious household, is that the danger is always in this idea that there's a single right thing, that there's a single narrative, that there's a single Arab experience, that there's a single Muslim experience, that there's a single queer Arab experience, like that there is some kind of one narrative that will encompass all of those things,
yeah, yeah.
and one narrative that is the story, I think that's always the danger. And I think the more that we can see that there are different kinds of people and different ways of moving through space and different ways in which our identities affect the way we move through space, like the better we will be.
Absolutely. And we won't have as much imposter syndrome, like, oh wait, I don't really fit the standard narrative, so should I be telling this story or participating in it?
Yeah, I don't look like all these dead white male authors. Can I be an author?
Yeah.
I don't look like the kind of women I've seen running businesses. Am I allowed to run? It's funny how like just being able to see it really does affect the way you see yourself. And that is also why I put girls like Rachel wants to be a filmmaker and Sana wants to be a surgeon. And
yes,
like
I love that.
People who have different kinds of futures, both creative and in STEM, and and that they're allowed to have those ambitions and also be who they are, I think is really, really important for just envisioning yourself.
Yeah, it's really refreshing. Before we end this, can you talk about whatever you're able to talk about, what you're working on right now?
Yeah, so I'm in two copy edits for my third book. It's called This Is All Your Fault, and it is what I like to think of as Empire Records in a bookstore. So three girls who work together, who think they know each other, have a day to save their dying bookstore in Chicago, their dying independent bookstore in Chicago. And they kind of learn about each other on the way. Yeah. So
when is it coming out?
June. It's next June. I think it's the, whatever the Tuesday is, like third maybe, but it's that first week in June, 2020.
Yay.
Yeah. So it was fun. There's another, Muslim Arab girl in there.
Oh, awesome.
And it's kind of become an exploration that I didn't mean to deal with growing up in mental health and what it means to try to fight a battle, not the mental health part, but the idea that they're fighting this losing battle, trying to save an independent bookstore that's dying. And I wanted to explore what it means to kind of get in the ring when you think you might not be able to win.
Oh, I love that. And like the bond that you can form in that experience with each other.
Yeah, it's like one girl's kind of a bookstagrammer, and she's Latinx, and another girl is Greek American, and she's like a cool girl and a closeted poet, and then another girl is she's Arab American, and she's dealing with depression, and she's not admitting it to herself, and she kind of opens by shaving off her head, like shaving. Speaking of hair, she shaves all of her hair off, which is like the crowning, like as anyone who's listening who's Arab and is identifies as female will know that that's like the crowning glory of being an Arab American girl, is like that thick shining black hair. And it was really cathartic to write all three of them and to deal with like their anger and their anxiety and their depression and their trying to see each other, the way they see each other, and then the way they actually get to know each other is totally different. And I think that was really fun.
That's so cool.
We come to the table, I think, with so many assumptions.
Yeah, like when you have a shared objective and how that can change your...
Yeah, you're like your temporary allies, and then you realize you respect the person because you're like, oh, you actually, you just do this differently. Like, we want the same thing, you just do it differently.
Yeah, yeah. In the end, we all just have the same goal here. I really, I can't wait. So how can people follow you? Can you, or contact you, whatever you are willing to share?
I am at Amina May. I'm largely on Instagram. I'm also at Amina May on Twitter and most places on the internet. Like it's aminamay.com, but I'm mostly on Instagram and I'm most active there. You can also shoot me an email. My email is on my web. I have a contact form there.
Cool.
And I think that's most of it. I think it's actually at Amina May Safi on Facebook, but I almost never check that. So I think that's mostly a placeholder for like, please go to Twitter and Instagram.
yeah, I know. Facebook's slowly going down to the bottom rung of like social media.
Yeah,
like our Facebook page.
Well, I think it's because I deleted most social from my phone because I wanted to like not constantly be inundated.
But you can't
with Instagram. It's like the only one that's actually on my phone that I have access to like most of the time. So that's really what happened.
Yeah, like that's the one you can't just go on.
Your laptop. Yeah, you can't post from the web. Yeah. So that's why. Yeah, if I could post from my web, I probably would be on it a lot less too.
Oh, right. I know. And same with us, like our Facebook page is so quiet compared to like Instagram. So everyone listening, you can follow us at The Queer Arabs, Facebook if you really want to, and Instagram and Twitter. And then we have email address, thequeerarabs@gmail.com. And Ahmed's the host of the Arabic side of the podcast, so you can reach out to him at thequeerarabsinarabic@gmail.com. And our website is thequeerarabs.com. So thank you so much, Amina. It was an honor to have you on this.
Talking to you. Thank you so much for having me.
This was a very cathartic conversation.
Oh, good.
It's like, oh, we get it. We get each other.
We do.
Really appreciate
it. Kids, we stick together.
Yeah, we do. We have to.